Thing over. Now your council and your mayor, when they sit down in consultation, when we have meetings, and these are open meetings, incidentally, every meeting that we've had on budgets, any special meetings that we've had, they are not closed meetings. And despite a little article I read in one of the weekly papers, we do not have these closed meetings. These are open to reporters. They start at 7 o'clock in the morning. Let me tell you this, that this council and your mayor have been meeting for the last 2 weeks on this thing every morning at 7 o'clock at the Traveler's Inn, and we have ran from 7 to 10. If the people do not come, that is bad. I do like to see a number of people. We had a number down at the last meeting. We did have a reporter there from the Daily, and I was thankful for that. We hold the meetings in the morning because we feel at that time at 7 o'clock that probably more people could come to them. We have many other meetings in the evening. So that in order to get the job, the tremendously big job that is being done on this budget, we must have morning meetings. We do not hold them at noon because I feel, in my own mind, that noon meetings preclude many working people from coming to a meeting with a problem, whether we are in working on a budget and discussing budgets, or whether we are merely in discussing general government. I think that noon meetings are very difficult for people to get into. However, if a person did wish to appear on an agenda at a morning meeting, every Wednesday we have a meeting at the Model Cafe, and these are discussion meetings, and any person desiring to be on there could contact the city manager if it were a working person and could be in there at 7 o'clock and be first on the agenda as far as I'm concerned. We do not want to preclude any citizen from being at any of our meetings, the only meetings in the charter which preclude persons from coming to them are executive meetings, which are called for the purpose of putting somebody on the carpet. It's no more or no less than that. And it may be when a person is on the carpet for something where he may have derogatory statements made about him. This we do not want, and it is not wanted in the charter and in the ordinances to be made public at that time, because until these things are proven or refuted. And of course, you can understand that. But we do not have secret meetings on budgets. These meetings are wide open, and any reporters, newscasters, or anybody of that nature can come to them, and we certainly hope they do. We had a very good meeting here the other day with the school board, some interested citizens, and some newspaper people, and I was very, very happy to see them there. Getting back to some of the things I want to come out with on our budget here, tax data for the city of Fairbanks as of March 31st and 62. The assessed valuation of the city of Fairbanks that we have for 1962 was $76,692.50, of which we levied a 19.9 mil levy, or an amount of $1,526,172. Now that was on $76,692,000 of total evaluation. I might say this, I will probably, let me look at the itinerary here. We have Sunday, Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, and again next Sunday. Probably next Sunday, we'll go into the manner and the rule of thumb in which we assess property. I see I have a couple of minutes left here. I want to say that here from this budget that we have an estimated revenue in the general government. Now I want to break apart general government and municipal utilities. I see in the paper many times the inclusion of utilities and general government. Now I'm going to talk on a general government fund, which is what is going to be of interest to you at this time. And our general government estimated revenues is $4,327,057. The appropriations requested by the administration are $4,327,057. So that our estimated revenues and our requested appropriations are duplicates, $4,327,000 against 4,327,000. Obviously, we cannot live with this budget, and we will not, most certainly. The council realizes this, I realize it, and so does the administration. This is a preliminary budget. We are working day and night on it. It's quite obvious that if we accepted a budget with an estimated revenue and a request for appropriations for the exact amount of revenues, that in the event we went over our costs of operating the city, we would be in deficit if we failed to get a certain amount of money of revenues, even $1. We would be in deficit now. I want you to understand, we are cutting this budget down. I will go into the, in future talks, beginning next Tuesday again, we'll go through this budget categorically. I want you to know what the departments have requested, what it takes to run the various departments, the expenditures for capital outlay, the working capital fund. I would like to go through the municipal utilities budget and what they consider they have to have. And again, I would like to go through the school budget and show you that and make a comparison on it. I will keep you informed at all times what the council is doing with this budget, which is the city's of $4,327,000, how we are cutting it, what we are going to cut it to, and how we're going to keep this tax mill levy down to a point that the people who pay it can live with it. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your time. I hope that it has been of some interest to you. Let me say before I leave that if you have any questions as to the budget or as to how your government operates in certain circumstances, please call the station here at Globe 2-3656 or Globe 2-2468. I will answer those questions at following meetings, if I possibly can. I would ask this, that you do refrain from asking questions such as, how come we've got a half a dozen trucks down here at Joe's Cafe in the morning? Now, these are administrative problems of which I have no control. I have looked into them at various times, and most certainly they are incidental things that do happen, and I realize that they hurt the people, and the outlook on it is bad. I would like to particularly keep the request for information to the budget and to the operation of the government generally, your city council, the administration, and your bondings. And thanks again.
This has concluded the first in a series of public service programs on discussion of the city affairs. KTVF has presented Mayor Darrell Brewington from its studios. This extremely important subject matter poses many problems, and this channel invites any of the audience to inform us tomorrow morning after 9 a.m. on their reactions or questions to be considered for ensuing programs on this topic. CBS for the Interior, KTVF, Channel 11 in Fairbanks, Alaska.
Around the zoning of their particular area. They're presently scheduled to move by December 22nd. Ingram told the council he's attempting to have the area rezoned. Stanley Samuelson Jr. of 240 Mini Street said the building office has refused him a building permit to make repairs on his home, which burned some time ago. Samuelson said the insurance company is willing to pay. The contract has been let and the job estimate is $250. He said the reason given so far for the denial has been the electrical wiring and a portion of the house having been burned. This, he told the council, would not be a valid reason for holding the permit because the cause of the blaze was attributed to an overheated stove. The matter was referred to the city manager for appropriate administrative action. Gregory Shumeff appeared before the council last night to ask for condemnation proceedings against his property be held off until his lawyer, who is presently in a hospital, is in better health and can speak before the council. An extension had been granted some time ago through city ordinance. Since the regular business had concluded, a unanimous consent by the council was required to bring a motion on the floor, and Red Boucher objected to the procedure, saying that the man had had ample time and the city needed to enforce some of the ordinances it passed. In the city manager's report, Robert Crow today told a council the Boundary Commission hearing on annexation of Island Homes in the Grail area will be held in the Chamber Law Cabin at 8 p.m. on Wednesday. He also said the city finance director has been given a copy of the city budget and a large pair of shears, and an amended proposed budget will be ready for the council's consideration Friday morning for a conference meeting.
News for and about Alaskans presented in full coverage report.
That was a November 26th, Monday evening council meeting report on Tuesday morning, November the 27th at 7:15 to 7:30 a.m. in the morning.
The bank urges you to see them about their new automobile time plan. News on the local, state, national, international, and of course the stock scene too, featuring your hometown reporter Maury Smith. And right now, let's say good morning to Maury.
Good morning, Bill Woolley, and hello everyone. A fire of undetermined origin destroyed the major portion of the Interior Airways hangar at International Airport last night. I'd like to point out this is the old hangar, not the new one. The Fairbanks Fire Department responded to mutual aid requests from the International Airport Fire Department, as did the Fort Wainwright Department, at a little after 7:30 last evening. There were no planes in the old hangar, firemen said. Damages were to a battery room, garage and storage area, and offices, all located on the first floor. Jim McGoffin, owner of the hangar, was en route back to Fairbanks from his annual pheasant hunting expedition to South Dakota with friends and is expected in today after being delayed at Fort St. John. Benny Rainier of 703 23rd Avenue was taken to St. Joseph's Hospital yesterday afternoon when he was found in the yard of his home, possibly overcome by smoke, is in fair condition at St. Joseph's Hospital this morning. Rainier had been working in his basement and a small fire produced smoke that drove him out of the basement. A meter reader found him and summoned help. I'm reminded last night during the regular meeting, eager regular Monday evening session, that an important local boundary commission hearing will be held on Thursday evening of this week at 8 o'clock in the Chamber of Commerce log cabin on First Avenue. This hearing, City Attorney Barry Jackson pointed out, will be concerned primarily with Island Homes and Grail only. However, it is expected that some discussion will be given to a petition for Rabbit Island, South Fairbanks on 23rd Avenue, and the city dump area and city cemetery at Birch Hill. Persons who are interested in the possible annexation to Fairbanks of Grail and Island Homes, or a portion of Grail and Island Homes, are invited to present their views to the commission on Thursday night. And once again, that time is 8 o'clock, and the place is the Chamber of Commerce log cabin on First Avenue. In other matters, the council okayed the subdivision of a portion of Block 143, which lies south of the Wiener subdivision between Lathrop and Stewart Streets and on the north side of 10th Avenue, into five lots. These are city-owned and will be sold. The council also passed an ordinance making the seal of Fairbanks that has been in use for some time official. This will not necessitate any reprinting of forms, letterheads, making of decals, and so on, and should cost not more than about $15 altogether, Mayor Darrell Brewington said. The council authorized the signing of a new contract for the jail and juvenile detention facilities at a figure that has been steady for several years. Torgerson Brothers Plumbing and Heating, which had until December 22nd of this year to move from its present location on Lower 3rd Avenue as a non-conforming use, was given until next spring, and in the meantime, the council will review all non-conforming use permits, some of which Mrs. Sylvia Ringstead pointed out may be in violation. This matter will be on Wednesday morning conference agenda, and in the meantime, the city attorney is to investigate others. Torgerson's attorney told the council last night that the company had tried to move last summer, but the business in Fairbanks had been not too good, and it would have been an expensive move. He also said that some 80% of the residents of the area were willing to sign a petition to have the district rezoned to industrial due to its proximity primarily to the city's power plant. Robert D. Hartwell, son of Mr. and Mrs. Robert E. Hartwell of 420 Church Street here in Fairbanks, completed recruit training October 26 on the Naval Training Center at Great Lakes, Illinois. And a Fairbanks girl won honorable mention in a 4-H club contest nationally. College scholarships of $400 were awarded today to 24 4-H club leaders for their work in leadership, electric projects, and with dairy foods. The winners were announced at the 41st Annual 4-H Club Congress assembled in Chicago. In addition, 51 state and territorial dress review winners modeled their homemade clothing in a hotel grand ballroom. Their prizes were a trip to the Congress and a complete scissor set. The 4-H Club member honored here from Fairbanks included, or was rather, or is, for her dress review, Kathy Harris, 16. Three inspectors responsible to Alaska are making daily progress reports on the work on three ferries being constructed for the state in the Seattle shipyard, Public Works Commissioner Richard A. Downing said today in Juneau. Downing said the three men operating out of the office of Philip Spaulding, Seattle Marine Architect, who designed the three ferries, are under construction to note the reasons for any construction delays. The list goes into considerable detail and is quite long. Briefly, what it is a local show. I believe this is on another channel than ours. At any rate, it's a good show, the Dobie Gillis show the other night. in which the dean of a small school and the coach, football coach of the same school, were in discussion regarding a quarterback that they apparently needed rather badly, when along came a great big husky fellow with a piano on his back. And they called him over, and he stood there and talked to them for a while with a piano on his back. Apparently didn't bother him much. And they thought possibly this fellow might make a good quarterback. So the dean said, well, let's give him an entrance examination to good old PIU or whatever the school was, and right here on the spot. So he turned to the big fellow and he said, what's two and two? The fellow says, seven. And the dean says, you know, he said, this is stretching, and I know that football is important. We've got to have a good quarterback, but this is stretching it just a little bit. The coach piped up real quickly and said, well, Dean, said he only missed it by one. Well, that's about it. We'll have more news throughout the morning here at KFAR on the hour. In the meantime,
past eight. After passing through the dry parts of the agenda, which included almost everything that appeared under new and old business, last night's council session once again was spiced by the appearance of the citizenry with special requests. Millard Ingram, local attorney, came forward in behalf of the Torgerson Plumbing and Heating Firm, asking for an extension of the city ordinance made 9 years ago, which would force them to move their offices to a new location. The law was made to help them get around the zoning of their particular area. They're presently scheduled to move by December 22nd. Ingram told the council he's attempting to have the area rezoned. Stanley Samuelson, Jr. of 240 Mini Street said the building office has refused him a building permit to make repairs on his home, which burned some time ago. Samuelson said the insurance company is willing to pay. The contract has been let and the job estimate is $250. He said the reason given so far for the denial has been the electrical wiring in a portion of the house having been burned. This, he told the council, would not be a valid reason for holding the permit because the cause of the blaze was attributed to an overheated stove. The matter was referred to the city manager for appropriate administrative action. Gregory Shumaff appeared before the council last night to ask that condemnation proceedings against his property be held off until his lawyer, who is presently in the hospital, is in better health and can speak before the council. An extension had been granted some time ago through city ordinance. Since the regular business had concluded, a unanimous consent by the council was required to bring a motion on the floor, and Red Boucher objected to the procedure, saying that the man had ample time and the city needed to enforce some of the ordinances it passed. In the city manager's report, Robert Crow told the council the boundary commission hearing on the annexation of Island Homes in the Grail area will be held in the Chamber Log Cabin 8 p.m. on Wednesday. He also said the city finance director had been given a copy of the city budget and a large pair of shears, and an amended proposed budget will be ready for the council's consideration Friday morning for a conference meeting. Now, in line with KFRB's public service policies, reporting for the Alaska State Police, here is...
Persons who have not paid their city property tax, and I'd like to read from it. It's a little difficult to sum this up, and it will take just a few minutes. I think you'll find it at least interesting and informing. And I'm quoting directly from Doris Lenny. This is not me. I have just seen the 1962 real estate tax foreclosure list, and I find myself disturbed as I realize that again the city has seen fit to enforce the most oppressive and stringent city ordinance. I'm writing the council to ask that it consider the possibility of amending the city ordinance, which provides for the commencement of foreclosure proceedings 30 days after the city real estate taxes become delinquent, in order to provide a longer period of delinquency before foreclosure proceedings are instituted. I would hazard a guess, as Lenning said, that no other taxing body in the nation enforces its real estate tax liens with such stringency. I'm aware that because of the great strides the city is attempting to make in civic improvements and the services that the city taxes must be collected as quickly as possible. Certainly, to the extent that the citizens can pay, they do. After all, who, if he has the money to pay, will willingly incur the 10% penalty plus the 8% interest on delinquent taxes? Obviously, Ms. Lenning said, the taxpayer who isn't financially able to pay isn't aided by peremptory tax foreclosure proceedings that add to his tax burden, court costs, publication costs, and filing fees. The city fathers certainly should be aware that we have a fluctuating economy. Many laborers, after several months of unemployment, can't meet two tax payments in a three-month period. And since we no longer have the problem of collecting a personal property tax, why can't we go back to a six-month span between tax payments? And to sum up a rather lengthy argument, she goes on at great length, which I cannot bring here, it just is too long. To sum up my rather lengthy arguments, Miss Lennox said, shouldn't the city government be or re-examine its policies in regard to tax enforcement against a fractional difference in bonding interest rate, the advantage given by the tax informant as such? A 10% penalty plus 8% interest collected in delinquent taxes, surely the city isn't losing, and the citizen who can and does pay his taxes isn't being unfairly treated if his less financially fortunate neighbor is given a little more time to pay his taxes. This letter, of course, was taken into consideration by the council last night. Dick, you're due. Are you all ready?
I'm ready.
You got some values?
Group, I would like to now introduce to you the members of a panel that I have beside me here this evening and who will participate in this particular program. First, I'd like to introduce Mrs. Janet Baird, who is secretary of the study group and a very, very fine member who is very, very interested in this question of the borough, establishment of the borough. On my immediate right is Dr. Ed Boggan, member of the state legislature, served in the second state legislature, and will be going back to Juneau come January to continue the good work that he has already performed there. On my immediate left is Mrs. James Dalton, a member of the study group, a chairman of several of the committees, a very, very active worker in this particular area, and one who has participated in the borough question and study over a period of time from the beginning of the consideration by the state legislature 4 years ago. And to my far left is an old friend of mine, Mr. Jim Dugan. Jim and I were raised in southeastern Alaska together, and here we find ourselves once more on a program on TV. Jim is a member, or was a member, of the Constitutional Convention, which met in 1955 here in Fairbanks, and is the only member in the Fairbanks area who served on the local government committee. Now, the program that we have arranged for this evening is, I think, well organized, but not too many of us have had time to really work out some of the details. So we're going to do the best we can within the next hour or more to present to you in the first 30 minutes. Perhaps many of the questions that are in your minds will be answered by these presentations, and they will be made by the individual members here on the panel. We will cover the question from the beginning, at the time it was under consideration first in the Constitutional Convention, and we'll bring to you the all the activity that has taken place from that time up until the present time, and we'll, we hope, paint a picture for you that will give you some idea of where we stand in the local Fairbanks area on this particular subject. The balance of the program, or the last 30 minutes of this program, will be a question and answer period. The questions we hope will come from you. We want you to participate with us, and if you care to ask a question of this panel, you should phone the station. The numbers to dial are Globe 22468 or Globe 23636. Now, I think at this time we will go ahead now with the presentation by the various panelists. First, I'd like to call upon Mr. James Dugan to discuss for you the constitutional concept of borough government. Jim, can you take over from now?
Thank you, Frank. It's been almost 7 years since the Constitutional Convention met in November of 1955. I know that I, like the rest of the seven members of the Committee of Local Government, approached the problem of local government with a great deal of awe, a great deal of indecisiveness as to knowing exactly what form of local government should be provided for the state of Alaska. It was quite surprising to me to find that the other members of the committee that I associated with, after generally discussing the problem for 2 or 3 days, found that we were pretty much in agreement in our ideas as to what we didn't want. The term county, as it is used throughout the states, is a connotation that is derived or thought to have been derived in the early days, where a person could ride in horseback in any one direction in a day's time from the county seat, and that established the boundaries of the county. Almost unanimously, the members, the 55 members of the Constitutional Convention, said to us that whatever you do, don't saddle us with counties. And that's the way that we started. After discussing what we thought were many, many of the needs of the people throughout the state, we derived the name borough, and we derived it for one reason. I realized that the term borough and what it embraces has been a source of sore concern to a good many people. It has probably scared a good many people. And not that I'm any smarter than anybody else, but it shouldn't scare anybody. Borough, as it was intended to be, in its first concept, is nothing other than a name. In its final concept, it's an area of land that is inhabited by a group of people who have decided to set up some form of government for themselves between the level of state government and the level of city government. As most of you well realize, the state is a large and complex organization, and that in many areas, for people to try and get from the state the things that they need, it's like waving at windmills. They either aren't heard, or there's not time, or there's no money. And in cities who are busy trying to provide for the needs of the people in the immediate area, they neither have the time nor the money, nor do they have the power under state law to go outside their limits if they wanted to and try and help their neighbors, the people living in the urban area. In trying to set up what a concept of a borough is, the local government committee of the Constitutional Convention tried to set an intermediate level of state government that would fill the need between the city and the state, and at the same time provide that they avoid all of the evils that went with county government. The minute that you say county, you have a county sheriff, a county assessor, county health officer, county this, county that, county something else. It goes with county. In trying to set up this concept of borough, we tried to set up an idea that you would have as much government as you wanted and felt willing to pay for, and as little government as you felt that you needed. Not long ago, a few years ago, the people throughout Alaska were in sore distress over the fact that they were a territory and that they had no voice in the laws that were made for them or in any of the governmental functions. It was all provided from Washington. Under territorial government and then under state government, you still have the same problem. The power of government is quite distant removed from you as you think of where the capital is. We tried to provide that each and every person that was interested in government would be given the right and the power to say for themselves what type of government that they would have. This is what a borough is. You get as much government as you want and as little as you think that you need. We tried to provide that as you have in other forms of government, particularly counties, particularly in some of the old boroughs that are known in the east, the parishes in the south, the counties throughout the state, that we would prevent an overlapping of taxation and a pyramiding of taxing entities. When I say an overlapping of taxation, as many of you know that have come from the South 48, you want to pay your health taxes, you pay them one place. You want to pay your fire taxes, you pay them someplace else. You can't seem to ever stop running around from different offices to find out where you pay this. In the pyramiding of taxing entities, we tried to prevent the fact that every time that there is a service district or a special service district, anything that you, the people, need, that there would be set up a special board, clerk, or what other governmental agency is thought necessary, so that with it went the added cost. We tried to provide in this borough that there be a borough assembly. The assembly would have all the powers of assessing and taxing. It would be their responsibility, no matter how large nor small the borough is. They would determine the assessment, they would determine the tax, and they would collect it all. As you know now, you have, in this particular area, you have two functions of taxing entities with their particular powers of collection, namely the city and the school district. As it is under the law, the city has the final say on the school district budget. Many people complain that this isn't right. I don't know whether it's right or not. I think the only reason that the law was provided the way that it was done was to possibly prevent school districts from bankrupting municipalities. I don't know, but that's what I think. In providing the borough assembly with the power of taxing and assessing, we delegated to one authority, no matter if you had 10 school districts, 10 fire districts, 10 health districts, and 10 cities, that one authority would decide, outside of the city limits of any city, the tax would be for the area, and they can demand of the cities that they pay their fair share of whatever tax is for an area-wide service. In the matter of special districts, for instance, a good example is the Hamilton Acres Public Utility District. Under this form of borough government, there can be as many of those type of districts as people choose to want. In the case of the Hamilton Acres Public Utility District, no portion of that tax that goes to support that district will be borne by anybody else other than the Hamilton Acres people themselves. In forming these districts, if you want a road district, a water district, a sewage district, you can get your neighbors around you to agree that you should have such a thing. You can define its boundaries, present it to the borough assembly, and they give you the permission to go ahead. you can rest assured that you can have it, as long as you're willing to pay for it. The reason that you have to go to the Borough Assembly is because in many cases it's going to require bonding. It's going to require the full faith and credit of the borough to be behind those bonds, even though the tax is to be borne by only the people that benefit by this service. Under the present law, and I can't say that I agree with it, the law spells out that there will be a borough chairman and a borough manager and few other borough officials. I think in time that probably this law will change back to the original concept that was thought of by the Constitutional Conventions, or if somebody else can think of something better, it will change to that. The whole concept of the borough was that each and every person within a particular area had the right and the voice to determine for themselves what kind of government they will have and how much it will cost them. Thank you, Frank.
Thank you very much, Jim, for a very fine presentation. I'm sure that many of you have heard such terms as assembly apportionment, service area, first and second class borough, standards for organization, and so on. These questions will be answered right now when Mrs. Mike Dalton gives you the a presentation on the borough structure. Mrs. Dalton?
I think you're being pretty generous there when you say I answer all questions. We take my knitting needle pointer, and I'm going over here to this chart that we have prepared. This first chart we have covered here is just basically, or briefly, will show you the apportionment that we will probably have in the Fairbanks area. The borough law says that if there are two first-class cities, I'll just skip over these preliminaries and go into the problems we will have in as the apportionment schedule of the borough law applies to Fairbanks. We have in the law a schedule of population that would give us probably in this area, based on our population, probably will give us an 11-man assembly. That assembly will be apportioned. Each first-class city within a borough, and in this area we propose a borough that would include two first-class cities, Fairbanks and North Pole. And in case you did not, North Pole became a first-class city, moved up from third-class status to first-class about 1 year ago now. Then we will have two first-class cities. They are assured of at least one borough assemblyman from each first-class city. And since Fairbanks has the majority of population, I think North Pole has something like 400 at the very most within its 1 square mile. Fairbanks has something like 13,000. At any rate, under the apportionment schedule in our borough law, which I feel is a very fair schedule, the city of Fairbanks probably will have 4 members on the borough assembly. The city of North Pole, again a first-class city, but with a very small population compared to Fairbanks, 1. And that area in the borough, outside these two cities, probably will have 6. Now this, of course, depends a lot upon how we define our borough, where the boundaries will be, and how much population we will include in it. So this has much study to be done on it yet, and our borough study group is working on this thing at the very time, and probably we may alter this, but in all probability, this will be the way the borough assembly will be apportioned. Now I'm going to turn this over to another chart we have prepared here. I talk better with my hands. I do pretty well in my mouth, my husband says, and I do very well in my hands also. In the borough law, a borough can be established in an area that meets certain standards. Those standards that the law requires, now the Constitution first named these standards in very general terms and left it up to the legislature to define them more specifically. The borough law names four standards that an area must meet. The first, population. Population of the area proposed for incorporation shall be interrelated and integrated as to social, cultural, and economic activities. The second standard, I think we have here, I jumped, our schedule just makes, I see what we've done. We've made two standards out of one. The population standard will be considered from the integrated social and economic area. The population itself must be considered very carefully. If we had a population of 50 people, it would be an outlandish proposal to say we need a borough here, we need a borough because we need so much taxation. Well, 50 people are capable of providing so much taxation, so you can readily see that that is a consideration, the population. The population of this general area, just in very general terms, the area considered for borough incorporation is perhaps 25,000 people. The city with 13,000 and the rest of the area, including North Pole, is another 12. The boundaries are a very important standard that must be met. And the law says that the boundaries of the proposed organized borough shall conform generally to the natural geography of the area proposed for incorporation. And this, these boundaries shall include all areas necessary and proper for the full development of integrated local governmental services. Then, of course, the economy of the area. Can you afford it or can you not afford it? That's a simple one. I won't have to go into that. I think anybody can understand that one very well. And our last standard for the incorporation of a borough that we must meet to conform with the law and our Constitution is transportation. And Fairbanks, being what it is a natural hub of transportation. We're the center of a vast air network. We are on a river that will be navigable up to the University Bridge as of next summer. But we are on a river system of transportation, and of course we're on at the central point of a vast road, we hope a more vast road system of transportation. I'm going to go on over to another section of the borough law. I hope you understand that we're going very rapidly tonight over many things, and we hope in the future that we can return to these in more specific terms. The powers of a borough. There are two classes of boroughs that we can form in Alaska. And as Mr. Dugan pointed out, a borough is not a county, but it is a form of local government. It's similar to a county, but it certainly is not a county. A first-class borough would be the same under our present borough law as a first-class city. And if you can picture the many, many, many activities, duties, and regulations connected with the city of Fairbanks, for instance, you can picture what a first-class borough might be. Another class of borough that's allowable in Alaska is a second-class borough. And this, I'll say right now, this is the class of borough we are seeking in this area. A second-class borough can have the same number of powers as a first-class borough if the people in that area want the same number of powers. The mandatory powers under either class of borough are three: education or school, planning and zoning, and tax assessment and collection. These are three mandatory powers that the borough law requires in either a first or second class borough. The difference between a first and a second class borough is that it depends upon the people originally. If we want a first class borough with all the powers of a first class city, then we shall so state in our original petition when asking for incorporation. A second class borough differs in that we ask to become a second class borough, but we ask for only the three mandatory powers included in the law. But we may add another power if we care to. And then once the borough is in operation, the main difference between a first and a second class borough is that a first class borough can, the assembly may sit and may pass ordinances and can sit like the I'll just go back to the city of Fairbanks, can sit as a as the assembly and just legislate and pass ordinances until 3 o'clock every time they meet, 3 o'clock in the morning every time they meet. And in the second class borough, the assembly is limited in the powers it has. It has these three, it controls these three powers, but it may not have any more powers unless it goes to the people and asks the people what powers they would like. So for this reason, in the Fairbanks area, the borough study group now is seeking a second class borough, which would give us the power to go ahead and I can see by the clock that I'm getting too long-winded. I'm talking too much with my hands. So I'll just go on to this last chart we have here. This briefly will cover the service areas of a borough. And as Mr. Dugan has explained already, a service area is what you might picture Hamilton Acres right now is a public utility district. It is a service area, in other words. Under a borough, this is just a schematic drawing of what we, the borough in this area certainly will not have a rectangular form like this. But all that area in this one large rectangle, we might consider a Fairbanks borough. The entire area, this entire borough, will have three mandatory powers already explained: education, tax assessment, and planning and zoning. The city of Fairbanks in this area will remain the city of Fairbanks. The city of North Pole will remain the city of North Pole. But in this area around Fairbanks, here's Hamilton Acres. People there would decided perhaps in the same boundary that they now have that they would like road maintenance, fire protection, street lighting, and sewers. And they would go to the borough assembly, which covers the entire area, and say, we in Hamilton Acres want to be a service district. Please make us a service district and taxes for these services: roads, fire, street lights, and sewers. So the borough assembly goes and contacts the people. The people are in accord. It's done if the people approve it. Now in college, the people in college where I live, we have no fire protection. If we could draw boundaries within any area and go to the borough assembly and say, we need fire protection. Will you please make us a service district for fire protection? Tax us for this service. We're glad to pay the taxes if we can have the fire protection. Everybody's in accord. The assembly thinks it's a good idea. They pass the ordinance. It is a service district for fire protection. Only those people within that area will be taxed for this one service. Lomita, the same thing. Goes to the assembly, wants certain services. Roads and fire protection in Lomita. The assembly thinks this is fine for Lomita. Lomita gets it. Then, if the same area wants to enlarge the library that the College Women's Club has had out in that area for several years, they can decide that they want to make a library district. These are all examples. I might add. And their area probably could be much larger, include a larger area, and they could go through the same process, asking for a service district for just for their library expenses. If the borough assembly approved, if the people approved in that area, it was legislated through the assembly, it happened, it became a library district. Only those people within this district would be taxed for this one library service. The same for North Pole down here. The city of North Pole still is a first-class city within this one large borough, and they could conceivably go ahead and create a service district five or six times larger than the city of North Pole for fire protection only. And if if the city of North Pole agreed, the people in the area agreed, the borough assembly agreed, everybody's happy, we make it a fire service district. Only those people within that area would be taxed for that one service. And only these people in college would be taxed for their fire district. The rest of the borough assembly in this borough in this area, these service district area, would not pay for any of those special services. I'm sorry I talked so long, Frank, and I'll sit down and be quiet now.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Dalton. I think that your presentation is very good, and it's going to clear up perhaps many of the questions that exist in the minds of our people out in the audience, and especially in connection with the service areas. Perhaps one of the most important problems or functions of the borough government is the responsibility that the borough has, the mandatory power for the responsibility for schools. I believe we're very fortunate this evening in having Dr. Boggan with us because of his vast experience in this field. Dr. Boggan has served many years as president of the Fairbanks School District School Board, and with 2 years behind him in the legislature and having served on the Local Affairs Committee of the House of Representatives, I'm sure that he is in a position to give us a very good report on the relationship between boroughs and schools. Dr. Boggan?
Well, thanks, Frank. I certainly appreciate your mention about background and everything, but I don't think it really amounts to so much. I was on the local government committee, and I assure you that this bill, before it became an act of the legislature, went through considerable study and research. It was originally drawn up by the local affairs agency of the state. It was presented to our term of the legislature after the first term had not taken any action on it. I believe they felt that more study was needed. Our committee had the bill in the first session of the last legislature, and I believe, if I remember right, that it passed the House. I'm not sure. Or it might not have passed the House. Anyway, it came to the House floor, and I think it passed the House and went to the Senate. However, in the interim period between the first and second session, considerable more thought was given to it, and it came back and was amended considerably. There's still a lot of belief that it's a little too complicated even yet. But I actually think that it appears more complicated than it is, and if it's explained, it isn't too puzzling. I'm going to try to stick to facts here and not to have any opinions, Mike.
Thank you.
As far as the schools are concerned, the section in the borough law pertaining to schools is very short. It simply states that each organized borough constitutes a borough school district. And that's about all. It tells how the school board shall be elected. It provides that the school board shall be elected at large. However, there is a provision for school boards to be elected by zones, which will be determined by the borough assembly if this manner is to be used. Of course, the relationship, the taxing, will be done by the borough assembly. The present law as provided for city school districts will be the law used for the borough assembly until it's repealed or changed the law with city school districts, the relationship of the school board with the city council is much the same as it is here. The city, the school board prepares a budget and presents it to the city council for approval or rejection. The borough assembly, after the borough is formed, will take the position of the council and will review the budget and either approve or disapprove of it. Now, the only other thing that will affect the school boards as far as finance is concerned is the power to bond and purchase land for schools. Actually, much of the capital investment will be done by the borough assembly. Of course, there will have to be a communication between the two groups that will see that everything is done properly. Now, if we form a borough locally here, I'm not a member of the study group, but I do read the paper, and I noticed that one of the proposals, or possibly the proposal at the present time, is to have the area include a larger area than is now within the school district. Of course, this will take in some populated areas outside of the present school district, which will be taxed, will have real property tax assessed on them, and also personal property tax. I'm going to bring this out a little later about personal property. I don't know whether it will be taxed or not. This is a local option. We have a problem existing in the state which will be taken care of by further legislation added to the borough law. That is the quite heavily populated areas that are not incorporated, not a part of any school district, nor have made any attempts to form a borough. Now, these people are getting their schools paid for by the rest of us who pay state taxes, gasoline tax, income tax, and every other form of tax. It goes into the general fund, and ultimately part of it is used for schools, a very great portion of it, and a large portion goes to these areas who pay no real property tax such as we do here. Now, boroughs, I think, a mandatory incorporation or formation of boroughs in these places would probably take care of that. There, I mentioned the fact that personal property tax is to be assessed, and this is true. A law was passed by the legislature last year, Chapter 164, which provides for, it's called the Foundation Plan for School Finance, and it's, although that too seems complicated when you first look at it, it really simplifies the manner of financing schools, but the relationship between the state and the local school districts. This law provides that a certain millage, the amount raised locally shall be equal to a certain millage assessed on real and personal property. Now, this, of course, does not mean that personal property has to be taxed. I've been on a committee that's been working on this, and there's considerable disagreement and about whether personal property shall be taxed. Possibly, sometime it should be, and certain exemptions should be made. Now, there's another law in the, bill in the hopper that will come up into the next session of the legislature, and this is has to do with local organization of schools. And of course, the borough doesn't provide very much. It says that it shall apply as the present law applies. Now, the for want possibly of a better term, the state Board of Education calls each school district an administrative unit. Of course, this is just a simple name that is used. There seem to be some reluctance on part of some of the legislators to using that particular name because it isn't an administrative unit. It depends on other local government agencies to control. But I think when this law is passed, then that, with the Borough Act, will bring about a much better relationship between the state and local districts. It'll equalize the tax burden between presently incorporated areas and those that are not incorporated. Frank, I think that's about all I have to say right now.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Boggan. Certainly interesting, and I'm sure that you could take a good deal more time to go into the specifics of many of the points that you raised. When the time was offered to the committee by KTDF, station KTDF, I appointed a committee, a subcommittee, out of our big committee, and to arrange for this program, little thinking at the time that they would place me on the program, too. And in addition to having to act here as the master of ceremonies this evening, I have to make a presentation, too. I'll do what I can to inform you on a procedure for forming a borough. Now, I have before me the a manual that is published or produced by the Local Affairs Agency of the State Division within the Governor's Office. And it deals with the borough incorporation procedure. There are eight steps that must be taken, or should be taken at least, in the process to promote the establishment of a borough before the final incorporation takes place. First, we have the informal and formal discussions between interested persons, civic leaders, and local public officials on this question of forming a borough, getting into the question of whether it's necessary and so on. If these individuals feel strongly on the subject and want to go further with the question, then they go to the second step, which is to contact the local affairs agency, and from this agency they will secure information that is needed in order to learn the details involved in the organization of a borough and the procedure, of course, to follow in the incorporation. The third step is the organization, or the formal organization, of a borough study group, which will represent each and every section and interest within the largest area being considered for incorporation as an organized borough. Now, at this point, I'd like to point out to you that the Fairbanks area is very fortunate in having a great deal of informal and formal discussion, the formation of study groups, and also organizations that have dealt into this and studied the subject of the formation of a borough. For several years prior to this time, the Fairbanks Action Association was organized, and it did a very excellent piece of work in making a study of the local situation and in putting their findings down in the form of a report. This report has been is available and has been used to a great extent by the members of the present committee. However, for any number of reasons, of none of which I'm aware of it or know of at the point, the reason why, this committee has ceased to function, and last summer the informal talks and formal discussions began once again, and several interested people talked up the proposition of once more considering the formation of a borough. This brought on about by the fact that unless we have an amendment to the existing law, the